Is the Bible fake news?
Biblical archaeology.
Did you know they found Noah's Ark? If you've read newspapers for half a century or more, you'll know there's been more than one headline saying that. One man came back from Mount Ararat carrying a piece of wood, part of Noah's Ark, he said. But when it was subjected to the carbon 14 test, the results showed that it was less than 2,000 years old. Another claim continues to circulate among Bible-believing Christians, a boat-shaped feature which can be seen on the slope of Mount Ararat is the Ark. Its dimensions are said to fit with the measurements given in the book of Genesis. The protagonist of these claims, an American Seventh-day Adventist called Ron Wyatt, alleged that he found other elements in this place agreeing with the biblical description. But there are similar shapes in the ground of that region. So should we suppose Noah had a fleet of arks? No. Geologists explain the formations as the results of earthquakes. I'm sorry for the size of that picture. These formations are caused by mud in landslides pouring down the valleys of the mountain slopes, which you can understand from the previous slide. The landslides pour mud down the valleys of the mountain slopes and form these phenomena. They are not Noah's Ark. Why do people, especially evangelical Christians, want to find Noah's Ark? They answer, if we find Noah's Ark, everyone will have to believe the Bible is true. These people don't seem to be aware of the problems involved. Suppose we found an old boat on Mount Ararat. How would we know it was Noah's Ark, unless it had a brass plate on the side built by Noah and the sons? It might be the flood of the Babylonian flood hero Atrahasis, or the Greek flood hero Deucalion. Why should it be Noah's? We would need indisputable proof of its age. And then we should ask, what kind of vessel is it? In the Babylonian flood story, the Babylonian Noah built a round ark, according to a recently discovered text, a sort of enormous coracle, as you see on the slide here. Some of you may have watched a television program about it, which a colleague of mine, Irving Finkel at the British Museum, who'd found this description of the ark, attempted to reconstruct it as a sort of round vessel about 70 feet across. When they put it in the water, it sank. Noah's Ark, if you read in the book of Genesis, probably had a rectangular plan. It was not boat-shaped. In fact, it may have had a flat bottom with sides floating upwards, rising upwards to the roof. One thing deserves to be recognised. The Babylonian texts, the Hebrew texts, do not use any Hebrew word for ship or boat in connection with Noah's Ark. So alas, all the hundreds of toys that you see are not reliable representations. The Babylonian story does use words for ship or boat. But what Noah built was a container for him and his family. Our word ark is the Latin word arca, which simply means a box, which is a translation of the Hebrew word, which is used in Genesis for the structure that Noah built. After all, he didn't make it to go on a voyage. It didn't need a rudder or a mast or oars. It was simply to float on the water and keep the occupants safe. It was not a boat. So to look for a ship on Mount Ararat is probably a mistake. Furthermore, The book of Genesis says that the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat, not specifically on the peak, which is now termed Mount Ararat. And Ararat is the ancient name for the area known as Armenia, now partly in eastern Turkey, a much larger area than the modern state of Armenia. And other flood stories point to the same region. The Babylonian story may indicate the ark came to rest here in the Zagros Mountains, but we can't be sure of that. And Muslim tradition has it a little further west in southern Turkey. So the hunt for Noah's Ark is probably a waste of time and money. Would a discovery of Noah's Ark make people believe in the Bible? Well, finding it might imply that there's some truth in a story of a vessel used to escape from a flood. It wouldn't tell us anything about the reason for the flood or about the people who escaped. And even if there were some way of relating the discovery to the biblical account, identifying Noah as the builder, that could not substantiate the theology behind the biblical story. And ultimately, anyone eager to find Noah's Ark, thinking it would prove the Bible true, should recall the words of one who declared, "They will not be convinced, even if someone rises from the dead." Then we turn to another ark, the Ark of the Covenant. The same American, Ron Wyatt, went to Jerusalem looking for the Ark of the Covenant. He believed it was hidden in a cave there. Jewish tradition in the Apocrypha, second book of Maccabees, chapter 2, tells us that Jeremiah hid it in a cave on Mount Nebo. There's a view of Mount Nebo. But Wyatt argued that that should actually refer to Jerusalem, because from Mount Nebo, on a clear day, we can see across to Jerusalem. That picture wasn't taken on a clear day. So he hunted in part of an old quarry to the north of the old city of Jerusalem, near to Gordon's Calvary and the Garden Tomb. He found a tunnel and inserted himself into this tunnel and down between rocks and boulders, breaking some of them to get them out of the way. He burrowed down, he says, and reached a remote cavern where, by the light of a torch, he saw the Ark of the Covenant and all the other equipment from Solomon's temple. The online report of his expedition adds, "Just inside the chamber, by and near the original entrance, which was now sealed up, Wyatt found a total of 7 oil lamps that he believes had to have been left behind by those who brought the items into the chamber. The soot on the lamps and on the rocks they sat upon," he said, "clearly showed the direction of the breeze that followed the people into the tunnel. One of the lamps," the report continues, "is very ornate and displays Assyrian characteristics, which would be consistent with the cultural influence of Judah at the time just prior to the Babylonian captivity, just prior to Nebuchadnezzar's conquest." The report continues, the picture of this particular oil lamp was not taken with a camera because the lamp doesn't show up well in a photo, which I find very odd. "This picture was made by placing the lamp on a photocopier, and it revealed a little of the design. The centre depicts a goat or a ram standing upon its hind legs eating from a grapevine." Well, you might just about make that out. And they go on to try to connect it with the ram in the thicket in the story of Abraham. Anyone who knows anything about ancient lamps can tell at a glance that this one was made probably in the 5th century AD, about 1,000 years or so after the Assyrians. So it could not have been left in that place by the people who supposedly deposited the Ark of the Covenant there. It displays no Assyrian characteristics. And we have no record of anyone visiting this place later to have placed the lamp there. Wyatt failed to produce photographs of what he said he saw, the Ark of the Covenant, the Table of Showbread, and so forth. His family stated all his attempts to photograph anything in the chamber resulted in photos or slides that looked a complete blur. So he concluded that he simply wasn't supposed to take any photographs of these sacred objects. In fact, he failed to produce a single piece of evidence that independent investigators have been able to use to substantiate any of his discoveries. Beside Noah's Ark and the Ark of the Covenant, he located Sodom and Gomorrah, he found the wheels of Pharaoh's chariots on the floor of the Red Sea, Mount Sinai in Arabia, and an inscribed pillar set up for King Solomon on the shore of the Gulf of Aqaba. The conclusion has to be that these are the delusions of a devout Christian who believed he should be able to find anything the Bible described, and so to prove the Bible true. Regrettably, they are still circulating in print and on the internet and mislead many uninformed Christian readers. They are fake news. A third example, while some Christians search for proof of the Bible, their opponents try to show that the Bible is wrong. In the year 2007, a film and a book were published about the lost tomb of Jesus. They presented finds from a typical first century Jewish tomb, high-class tomb, cut in the rock outside Jerusalem. Such tombs had doorways like that, often quite small, and then there were chambers hollowed in the rock. Around the edge of the tomb there might be a bench cut in the rock and tunnels going from the bench into the walls of the tomb, each tunnel large enough to hold a human body. So the benches, the body would be placed in the tomb, and then a year later the bones would be collected and placed in a box of wood or stone, an ossuary, and you can see several in those tunnels on that plan. The stone ossuaries often survive, and some have the name of the dead person scratched or engraved on the side. And this particular tomb yielded six inscribed ossuaries. The names attracted the attention of two filmmakers, James Cameron and Simcha Jakubowicz, because they included Jesus, son of Joseph, Judah, son of Jesus, Mary and Mariamne and Joseph. Putting these names together, they said, "Don't you see? These are the names of Jesus' family. His father Joseph, his mother Mary, his son Judah, and his wife Mariamne, and a brother Joseph, and another relative Matthew." This all was presented in the film The Lost Tomb of Jesus and a book, The Jesus Family Tomb, and aroused a certain amount of publicity, because if they were right, they would disprove the resurrection of Jesus from the grave. Needless to say, there have been very critical reviews and refutations. Scholars have shown that these names were all common in the first century. In fact, another ossuary labelled Jesus, son of Joseph, was found in 1931, not a new discovery. Mary is among the most common of women's names. Joseph, Judah, and Jesus are among the common names of men found on ossuaries from the first century. That Mariah or Maria was the mother of Jesus, son of Joseph, Mariamne, the wife of Jesus, and Judah, their son, is entirely speculative. To be sure of these identifications, the relationships would have to be included with their names, as we have Jesus, son of Joseph, and as we find in many other tombs. So here is an example of people pressing evidence into a particular interpretation which it cannot bear, producing another piece of fake news. So on the one hand, we have fake news produced by people wanting to prove the Bible true. On the other, fake news produced by people wanting to prove the Bible false. Let's look at some more real news. All sorts of uncertainties surround archaeology. There is a hilltop, which you see here, in the valley of Elah, the valley where David and Goliath met, where surveyors had found pottery sherds from various periods in the past. Excavations were made there between 2007 and 2013. They uncovered a town which flourished for a short time, about 1000 BC, a period which the surveys had not recognised at all in the pottery finds. You can see on the slide remains of an encircling wall, a gateway, and another gateway here, and ruins of houses inside the town hall. There was a lot of pottery, stone and metalwork in the ruined buildings. The site, which is called Chebet Qiyafa, is clearly a town from the days of David, about 1000 BC. And it was unoccupied after that for many centuries. Hitherto, very few sites of that period have been recognised in Judah. And so a number of scholars have propagated the idea that David was not king of a large kingdom, but just of Jerusalem and a few villages around it. The excavator of this site argues that this place is evidence for strong central control from Jerusalem. The site reaches to the edge of the coastal plain and so attests David's power reaching to the border with Philistia. That may be so. Maybe we would like it to be so, but it has to be recognised it is an interpretation. The site itself doesn't say it was built for or by David. It doesn't prove David's existence. We could envisage a local chieftain fortifying the site, then falling to a stronger foe or dying from some illness and the site being abandoned. However, since 2013, two or three other places have been found not far away which show occupation from a similar date and in two cases with large stone walls around. So the probability of a strong kingdom at that period grows greater. One very exciting find was made in a house at Chebet Qiyafa. It's marked with X on the plan. And this shows again the need to explore alternative interpretations. It is a piece of broken pottery, which someone used as scrap paper. It has five lines of writing in ink. There's probably at least one more broken off at the top. This broken pottery used as scrap paper we call an ostracon. The letters are an early form of the alphabet. And Israeli scholars immediately read the first letters at the top left corner as Hebrew for don't do. And they tried to make sense of the rest of it as part of a message. And more adventurous experts want to read it as a message about social justice and even the establishment of a monarchy. As you can see, the writing is rubbed, uneven, and several of the letters have alternative stances. The letter A, it is actually the letter A, encircled in red, you see stands in different positions. It seems likely that this is the work of someone learning to write or someone who didn't write very often. Despite the assurance of many colleagues that this is a message, I'm not convinced. It seems to me that we're looking at a list of personal names, and the initial words that could be read in Hebrew as don't do can also be read as a personal name. The letters in the first line can easily be read as Semitic names with nothing distinctively Hebrew. And I was delighted to read a computerized analysis of the writing using artificial intelligence, which agreed with me. It is a list of names. So one up to artificial intelligence and one up to me. Given the broken and abraded state of this ostracon, we can do no more than offer vague suggestions about its meaning. But it is significant because we have no written documents from the time of David or thereabouts in Hebrew until this one was found. We have a few pots with people's names scratched on them. You know, you might write your name on your mug so that your brother didn't use it. But this is a connected text of some sort, even if it's only a list of names, like the list of the chieftains of Sukkoth that a boy wrote for Gideon. It indicates that there were people writing with pen and ink in Israel at a time from which hitherto no other examples had been known. And if we want to jump a little, we can say possibly it indicates that people were writing records, even books, at that time. The next area of real news concerns ancient Hebrew seals. Over the past 50 years, scores of small pieces of clay impressed by Hebrew seals have come to light in the Holy Land. You see them quite large on the screen. They're actually about the size of your thumbnail. And they were made by stones in signet rings or bracelets or on necklaces. A hoard of about 50 of these, which we call bullae, was expertly excavated in Jerusalem some 45 years ago and publicised. And treasure hunters suddenly realised that these things were valuable. They hadn't paid much attention to them before, and large numbers appeared on the antiquities market. Because so many turned up, people began to think that they were not ancient. One of them bore the name of Ahaz, son of Jotham, king of Judah. Is it really true? Others bore the name of Hezekiah, son of Ahaz, king of Judah. Is this really the seal used for Hezekiah? A number of factors weigh in favour of their antiquity, their authenticity, and the balance was tipped heavily that way when another example of Hezekiah, son of Ahaz, king of Judah, was found during archaeological excavations in Jerusalem, in ruins which were from the time of the Babylonian conquest. So we can assume that these bullae are genuine, and they bear the names of ancient Hebrews, mostly men, sometimes their father, sometimes their occupation. Ahaz and Hezekiah are among the Hebrew kings named in Assyrian inscriptions, which therefore corroborate their existence. The seal naming Jotham gives an example of another king of Judah, whose name is preserved outside the Bible. So here we have independent evidence for these rulers that are recorded in the Bible. As an aside, it's worth mentioning how well Hebrew scribes preserved the names of the kings of Assyria in the Bible. When written in the Assyrian cuneiform writing, these names are not quite the same as the Hebrew forms. So many commentators accused the Hebrew scribes of misrepresenting them. You know, if the president of Tajikistan visits London, the newspapers will spell his name in different ways because it's an alien name involving sounds that we don't have in English. Nobody knows quite how to write it. And people thought that the Hebrew scribes were just as lackadaisical as that. Here is a portrait of the king of Assyria named Sargon, the father of Sennacherib. He's mentioned once in the Bible in Isaiah chapter 20, verse 1. His name is written in Hebrew, Sargon, but in cuneiform, in Babylonian, it's written Sharkan. The vowels were not written in Hebrew. This teaches us that Assyrian scribes wrote this name in cuneiform in the Babylonian tradition. And if it had been written in Aramaic, it would have been written not with the letters S-R-G-N, as you see there, but with the letters S-R-K-N. Can we go back to
these?
Right. Excavations were made in the palace of that king Sargon to the east of Nineveh in the 1930s. And there was discovered the imprint of a seal belonging to one of his officials. And the seal has his name written in letters of the Aramaic alphabet, the same letters that were used for writing Hebrew. And we see that the Hebrew letters and the Aramaic letters are the same. This teaches us that Assyrian scribes wrote the name in Babylonian tradition, Sharkan, but in the Assyrian dialect it was pronounced Sargain, which the Aramaic and Hebrew letters reflect exactly. And if you travel about this country, you'll find the same word same words pronounced in different ways in different parts of the country. And people get confused if they visit us from North America when some places have spelt Sirencester and Sisister. So what we see is that the Hebrew scribes preserved the form of this king's name exactly in the form that it existed when he was ruling. Had they been working in Babylon a century and a half later, they would have used the Babylonian form. So the Hebrew scribes were exact in their transcriptions, and the copyists over the centuries preserved those transcriptions accurately. So when you have to read the Bible in public and you're upset because you mispronounced Tiglath-Pileser or Esarhaddon or one of the other names, remember that the Hebrew scribes had preserved them precisely as they were spoken. That was a bypass. Recently, an archaeologist has hailed a bulla, a seal impression, from the same excavations in Jerusalem where the Hezekiah example was found, as perhaps the seal of the prophet Isaiah. Although the impression is damaged at the top, it probably had a picture of a grazing doe, which we find on many seals. And the name in Hebrew letters below that is quite clear, it says Isaiah. But below that, there is another word. On many seals, the father's name would stand here, with or without the word son before it. On a smaller number of seals, in that position at the bottom, we would find the occupation of the owner, the scribe, the herald, and so on. The letters at the bottom of this seal are N-B-Y, and we'll come back to it. You can see at the bottom, and I've put them for the benefit of those who don't read ancient Hebrew. The letters are N-B-Y and probably one more. If the lost letter were an Aleph, letter A in effect, these letters would spell the word prophet, and that would be very exciting. But we would expect the letter H to stand at the beginning as the definite article. Can we go back one?
On the back.
That's one, yes. Here's an example. The seal of a man called Hananiah, the son of Hilkiah, the priest. And before the word priest, we have the letter H, which is the definite article, the priest. So on this seal, which is perhaps the Sea of Isaiah, we would expect the letter H. So without the letter H, and with the last letter missing, we cannot say that the word is prophet. They tried to argue that the letter H stood at the end of the previous line, and in this drawing, they've made it appear there. But in fact, close examination by a colleague of mine shows that there is not room for it there, and it would be very unusual for it to be separated from the word it's defining, prophet. So the identification of this seal's owner with the biblical prophet Isaiah is very unlikely. The second line may contain a father's name, which could be restored as Nebai, a name which is found in the Bible and on other seals. Archaeological research frequently produces information which illustrates biblical texts and shows how well they reflect their ancient contexts. In the centre of the Holy Land lies the site of Samaria, rather an old slide, I'm sorry. In the 1930s, ruins of a temple built by King Herod were uncovered there. Myself and my wife very long ago standing on those steps. And beneath them were found fragmentary walls of the palace of the kings of Israel. In the rubbish from these buildings were hundreds of pieces of ivory, beautifully carved to ornament wooden furniture. The Book of Kings has very little good to say about King Ahab. But among the deeds recorded at the end of the account of his reign was building an ivory house in Samaria. People used to think it was made of blocks of ivory or tusks, but discoveries show that rather it was enriched with ivory decorated furniture. And the prophet Amos condemned the wealthy people of his day for lolling on beds of ivory, which they bought by extracting taxes from the poor. And he said, you'll only get away with a leg of a bed or the corner of a couch. And you see, we find fragments of these things. What these pieces of ivory show us is the costly artistry which attracted the prophet's fury. And we now have hundreds, indeed thousands of pieces which were taken to Assyria as booty by the Assyrian kings and stored there in their palaces. You can see a display of quite a few in the British Museum. They show the height of luxury in ancient kings' palaces. King Solomon, you may recall, sat on an ivory throne, plated with gold. Here's an ivory throne. Of course, it wasn't solid ivory, it was wood, veneered with ivory. And in Solomon's case, plated with gold, somewhat like the wooden one that Tutankhamun sat on, which was plated with gold. So when we read those passages in the Bible that tell of the splendour of King Solomon, we shouldn't dismiss them as total exaggeration or imagination. They do reflect realities of those days, whether or not Solomon actually had such things. Archaeology deals with silence for the most part. The news it brings has to be interpreted. A ruined wall cannot tell us who built it, unless there's an inscription on it. Slaughtered bodies cannot tell us who killed them. One building on top of another may provide a sequence. And changes between them may point to changes in society. On this slide, you can just make out bricks of a wall here and here, which belong from a cover about 1300 BC, with houses of the present day standing on top. And the differences in culture between the two are enormous, although the occupants were probably all local farmers, as they are still. So we may link material remains from one place with others from another place, observing the same sequences, and work out an archaeological line of development, but only written sources can identify the inhabitants. That's why in this country and across Europe, archaeologists speak of one group of people as the beaker people, because their most characteristic product is this pottery beaker. But who they were, what language they spoke, we don't know. Just as early hominids are called Neanderthal after the German valley where their remains were first discovered, we don't know more about them. And even when there are written sources, it can be very difficult to relate them to hard facts on the ground. What are the first events in British history? The invasions by Julius Caesar in 55 and 54 BC. But no one has found any certain vestige of his invasion. Very recently, traces of camps have been found which have been attributed to Caesar, but we cannot be sure, and very little is yet known about them. And we have to remember that what Caesar tells us was in a book which was a defence of his activity to the Roman Senate. He'd not done what they wanted him to do, really, and so his book might be considered to contain a great deal of exaggeration. We might even ask, did he really come to Britain? After all, the Emperor Caligula, a little later, claimed to have conquered Britain, but he only collected shells from the French coast to take home as evidence. So we have to be careful. Again and again, ancient writers have been accused of peddling fake news. One example I like is the Greek historian Herodotus in the 4th century BC, who was ridiculed for his account of large rat-like creatures that threw out gold dust when they burrowed in an area of North India. What nonsense. Could you ever find such a thing? Well, you can. Marmosets, this creature, in northern Pakistan, is now firmly established, do throw out gold dust when they dig their burrows, and local people could still collect it, as they did in Herodotus' time. So the reputation of Herodotus is much higher now than it was a century ago. All too often, the Bible has been unfairly branded in the same way. A recent writer discussing the Exodus declared, "There is no way to salvage the biblical text as a description of an historical event. The current form of the story comes from the 7th to 5th centuries BC, with some early elements, perhaps a distant and distorted memory of an actual event." And he listed a number of discoveries which he claims proved the Exodus did not happen. In one case, he asserts that the name of the place Pithom, one of the two store cities that the Israelites built next to Ramses, Pithom has been excavated and nothing has been found there from the time of Moses. It was not occupied until just after Moses' time, until about 1200 BC. But although that book was published 2 years ago, the author is quite wrong. He was unaware that excavations since 2007 have uncovered more material from the 13th century and earlier, which could suit the time of Moses. So that author is purveying fake news, not the Bible. Archaeology has added enormously to knowledge of ancient times. So people expect it to tell us everything in the past. When they see there's no trace of the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt, nor any contemporary records of miracles performed by Jesus of Nazareth, many conclude that the Old Testament narratives were concocted in exilic and later times to foster early Judaism, and the gospel episodes were created late in the first century to support the early church. Should we conclude, therefore, that the biblical reports are fake news? It's all too easy to reach and propagate such a conclusion. Good reasons exist to explain the absence of footprints of the Exodus. What would you find if people were just camping like this. Groups of people trekking through a wilderness would only leave a few fire-blackened stones, and who could tell how old they were. How few documents there are from 1st century Palestine. This is a tattered legal deed from the time of Nero that was found in a cave near the Dead Sea, dehydrated and so surviving. It's worth noting that we have no documents of this sort from 1st century Rome. We have inscriptions on stone and metal, but nothing on papyrus or leather or wax-covered wooden tablets. All disappeared. No documentation for the greatest period of Roman history. There are cases where archaeology and the Bible appear to disagree, but both archaeology and biblical studies involve interpretation, and interpretation can produce misunderstanding. I want to assure you that no archaeological discovery indubitably contradicts a biblical statement. Taking all archaeological factors into account, over 60 years of study, I affirm that the Bible is not fake news. It is good news.